This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Indescribable, unutterable, unspeakable. Sometimes silence speaks louder than words. After 9/11, many Americans struggled to find the appropriate way to express their sadness and grief. Tonight, learning to talk through times of crisis when language seems inadequate. First, more words from the world's most wanted man. In a video broadcast today on the Arab news network Al Jazeera, Osama bin Laden said he was speaking, quote, 3 months after the blessed attack. Bob Drogon covers intelligence and national security for the Los Angeles Times. He joins us now from Washington. Good evening, Bob Drogon.
Good evening.
So what does Osama bin Laden say on this tape that's just been broadcast by Al Jazeera? Is there anything new? What's the tone and direction of his comments?
What's new is that he looks awful. He looks gaunt. He looks hollow-eyed. Mm-hmm. He looks, in the words of one official I spoke to tonight, shell-shocked. And I think that's probably right. What we don't know is when the tape was made, so we don't know if he's still alive now. But what he says on the tape is mostly more of the same of what we've heard from him before, which is essentially a mirror image of what the United States says about what happened on 9/11 and what the war in Afghanistan is all about.
For example?
For example, he terms his attacks as what he calls blessed strikes and mm-hmm. says the terrorism he practices is, quote, benign. He says the United States campaign in Afghanistan is a campaign of terrorism that has displaced millions of people and flattened thousands of villages. So it's always fascinating, I find, because you get to see the world that he is preaching or that he looks at and mm-hmm. that he's trying to sell to his followers.
Mm-hmm. And any verifiable indication whatsoever of when the tape was made, any hint, does it indicate anything about whether he's alive or dead?
The only thing it does, he makes a reference to a missile strike near a mosque in Khost that we believe occurred on November 18th. And he said that had occurred several days ago. Elsewhere on the tape, he refers to the 3 months since the attacks in New York and Washington and 2 months since the bombing campaign. The bombing campaign was October 6th, obviously 9/11. So we're talking about, assuming he's speaking the truth, that the tape was made at some point between November 18th and probably December 11th. So it's several weeks ago.
Now, the bombing of Tora Bora would have been about the end of that time that it began, would it not have been?
The bombing of Tora Bora began at about that period, that's right. And we don't know, again, if you remember back from that period, there was some suggestion that bin Laden might have been in the Kandahar area, and then suddenly there were claims he was in Tora Bora. Unlike other tapes where they were clearly indoors or in a cave or outside, this one is up against a Muslim, a burlap bag stretched across something. We don't know mm-hmm. if it's indoors or outdoors or what. Mm-hmm.
And you say, Bob Drogon, that he doesn't have that kind of satisfied, even smug look we saw in the famous tape released a couple of weeks ago where he was celebrating the 9/11 attacks.
No, we don't. One of the mysteries here is if this tape was indeed made on December 11th, which was 2 days before that tape you just referred to came out, why it took so long for it to appear, to show up. Al Jazeera said they only got the tape yesterday. But no, it's a very different kind of look. When that one, he was sort of gloating and boasting and whatnot. In this one, he looks almost in pain at times. Now, we've only seen, of course, just a few minutes of it. Al Jazeera is promising to release the rest of it tomorrow. I believe it's about 33 minutes in length, and we've only seen a few minutes.
Do you have any sense of why Al Jazeera would hold part of the tape for a day?
I imagine it has to do with ratings.
Tune in tomorrow.
There you go.
And Bob, what about the reaction of the U.S. government to the tape?
I think officially they're saying they're underwhelmed. They were caught off guard. They didn't expect it. They were obviously unnerved by the idea of Osama bin Laden, playing whack-a-mole, popping up out of a cave somewhere mm-hmm. at this point when we've got Marines and Special Forces guys going cave to cave out there. But barring that, I think they're still studying and trying to figure out what it shows. They don't have it all yet. I mean, they're also waiting for Al Jazeera to broadcast it. From what I understood in my conversations earlier tonight, that they haven't seen a great surprise through all of this.
Mm-hmm. Bob Drogon, thanks very much for joining us this evening.
My pleasure.
Bob Drogon covers intelligence for the Los Angeles Times. He joined us from Washington. Mm-hmm. After September 11th, sports announcers refrained from using words like killed, dot-coms no longer crashed and burned. Advertisers scanned their copy for suddenly off-color slogans. In times of crisis, the language we use seems to carry more weight. When words seem inadequate, what do we say to express our sadness and grief? What words have you found most comforting, most illuminating, most maddening? You can join our conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us now from San Francisco is Jeffrey Nunberg. He's a professor of linguistics at Stanford University and the author of The Way We Talk Now. Good evening, Jeffrey Nunberg.
Good evening. Thanks for having me.
Good to have you. And with us in the studios at WBUR is our own special coverage news analyst and the hardest working man in the news business, Jack Beatty. Jack, good to have you here.
Very, very pleased to be here with you, Tom.
Jeff Nunberg, we've seen a tremendous wall of words in response to what happened on September 11th. You study words for a living. Take us right back to the immediate aftermath of the crash of the towers and talk to us about how we struggled, and I guess in your view, ended up using Victorian language to try and capture the scale of outrage.
Yeah, there were really two kinds of reactions. The first was the immediate reaction that I think we all felt. The San Francisco Examiner's headline the morning after was just the one-word headline, bastards, right? Mm. I think it was what we all felt. But the politicians in particular felt the need for some language that would restore a sense of control or moral order. And you started hearing these, as you say, Victorian phrases. Dastardly was one that was used by Senator Schumer, by Governor Davis out here in California. A strange word, dastardly. I always think of the villain in a Gilbert and Sullivan operetta.
Right, but, right, or a silent movie twirling his mustache.
One thing that occurred to me, I think the real reason was it sounds like bastard, but it occurred to me it's the kind of word you pick up nowadays. Superman still uses dastardly and so on. And the whole thing had the flavor of a Lex Luthor operation. And there could have been some of that. But I think it was also, I mean, there was dastardly, there was nefarious. Bush used despicable. Mm-hmm. And there was this sense of trying to restore a kind of, those were the kinds of almost Victorian words. It was if this was the first war of the 21st century, the language was going to be the language of the 19th.
And, of course, there was infamy. The Pearl Harbor word was
infamy,
was
which
out.
Was an old-fashioned word when Roosevelt used it in 1941. So there's this sense of trying to restore some sense of an absolute moral order that old-fashioned language does for people, I think at least immediately after the attacks.
Jeffrey Nunberg, can you compare it to any other crises? How does language get re-geared and trotted out anew when circumstances change? And I guess when events are so traumatic, have you seen this happen before, that language itself is kind of revived or altered to address some stunning circumstance?
I don't think there's ever been, not in our lifetimes, anything of this magnitude where people all over the country, at least, are really in a state of shock and express that linguistically. And as you say, it's partly the words they use. It's more the words they don't use. You think of words like, you know, the adjective killer. I haven't heard much since 9/11.
In common parlance.
The adjective, she makes killer cocktails or killer restaurants. It used to be that meant that they had tomaine, but
now. Well, you've pointed out how much this language of war and violence actually permeates our everyday speech, or did before September 11th.
Oh, yeah. I looked, just the way we talk about killing, you know, you kill the lights, you kill a paragraph, you kill a half hour, you kill a quart of scotch. So we use those words very easily. And then more patently, things like, as I say, the adjective killer, the way we talk about in arguments. A linguist named George Lakoff has pointed out how often we talk about arguments. You know, she attacked his position, he had to retreat, and so on. And there's a sense in which there's a kind of play violence that pervades the language that all of a sudden was called into question by the very real violence that entered all our lives.
Jeff Nunberg, we're lucky to have with us tonight our own Jack Beatty, who a wizard of words himself. Jack, what have you been watching in the evolution of words this fall and winter?
Well, the one thing I did see was during the baseball that really leapt out at me was during the baseball playoffs, one of the sports commentators referred to, quote, the accident. He was trying to avoid controversy,
mm-hmm.
and he employed a talk about a gentilism.
The vanilla sky over New York.
Exactly. I mean, he just didn't want to upset the sponsors, and no one corrected him to the accident. But I think his awkwardness really is all of our awkwardnesses, and we get in trouble really with our adjectives, as Jeffrey is pointing out, unutterable, despicable, and all the rest of it. We just don't say attack or mass murder or it's despicable, it's unutterable, it's that color that we're bringing to it that either inflates it to this sort of Victorian level or has the other effect of really kind of deflating it, mm-hmm. and making it seem like, something you read in a book. I mean, Whitman said the real war doesn't get into books, and it's just very hard to put the emotions of September 11th and the events into language, especially when you dress it up with the adjectives.
Jeff Nunberg, why is that? Why do we walk so carefully in our language around September 11th? I mean, we have used outsized words at the same time. As Jack says, you can hear people, especially at the beginning before we'd come to a kind of national consensus about terms, and that's still changing, I'd say. But people being so careful in the way they describe this day, why do you think that is?
Well, I think September 11th dropped a very big elephant into the American living room. There was this event, that nobody really knew how to deal with. In a certain sense, I don't think it's a bad thing that people are slightly at a loss for words. I think there are times when language ought to fail you. And that's why sometimes those words you mentioned, like unutterable and unspeakable, are the most powerful things you can say, because what they say, in effect, is that events transcend the power of language to describe.
You've talked about a new circumspection since the 11th, which I guess is related to the same thing. But that's not that something's beyond the power of language to describe. It's that we're being careful lest we misstate reality in some way or step outside of the politically acceptable range of expression, isn't it?
Yeah, I think it's partly that. I think it's partly that we realize just how easily we refer to horror and death in a loose way in language without really realizing it. And, I just not long after the attacks, I was talking to a stockbroker and I was asking him when he thought things will kind of settle down. And he said, well, let's wait and see what happens after the dust clears. And then there's this long pause and he says, so to speak. And I was thinking how many times I've heard that phrase, so to speak, in the weeks immediately following the attacks. And there's another sense in which, Microsoft vice president about a year ago accused Apple, for example, of practicing patent terrorism. And there was a sense in which people used words like terrorism in a very loose way. And all of a sudden, people realized that word has a real sense and that it wasn't appropriate, maybe, to use the word in this loose way.
And you said even advertisers have changed their language. You've spoken particularly about Coca-Cola.
Right. Coca-Cola had a campaign. How did it go?
I think it's Life Tastes Good. They were planning to roll
out. Life Tastes Good.
And suddenly it tasted like ash this fall.
Right. And I think it was just too easy and upbeat. People were looking for something solemn, particularly immediately after the attacks. And they were pulling campaigns. There were record stations were circulating a playlist or don't playlist of songs that might evoke some Great Balls of Fire was one I remember on the list. Yeah, out. And people were just very, all of a sudden, in shock. And in the way when a death happens and all of a sudden everything seems to remind you of the people who have died. And in this sense, people really were trying to avoid referring to it or opening the wound. I think now people have gotten a little less circumspect than they were. And in fact, kids who don't have to this circumspection to the same extent we do are now using some of these words in playful ways. The high school kids are using terrorist as an insult with one another, and jihad, I know in some circles has become a way of saying cool, good, hey, that's jihad.
Yeah.
Wow. There's that absent concept of normalcy or normal. What does that mean anymore?
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. And I can't ever pronounce the word now without putting quotes around it.
There's quotes around everything, and Jeffrey Nunberg.
A lot of finger quotes.
Yeah, a lot of finger quotes floating above words these days. We're talking with Jeffrey Nunberg, author of The Way We Talk Now, a new book of his commentaries on language and culture from NPR's Fresh Air. You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. How is language helping you grapple with new realities? How is it tripping you up? Join the conversation. We're at 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR Boston. This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking tonight about the words we've used to describe the world since September 11th, how language is changing all around us, how it's changing inside our own minds. Our guest is Jeffrey Dunberg. He's author of the new book, The Way We Talk Now. He's chair of the usage panel of the American Heritage Dictionary and a professor of linguistics at Stanford University. We're also joined by our own special coverage news analyst, Jack Beatty. Jeffrey Dunberg, the labels of everything that's gone on have been shifting and changing, as you point out, since 9/11. How about that, the spot in New York itself? And, of course, we don't forget Pennsylvania and Washington, but so much attention has been focused on that disaster site, we're now told to call it. It was ground zero for a while. What have you noticed in the nomenclature of the sites themselves?
Yeah, I know that some people are uncomfortable about Ground Zero, and in particular, the relatives of some of the people who were killed in the attacks asked that it be referred to as the disaster site. I don't know whether Ground Zero sounds disrespectful or too much like a bomb went off.
Too Hollywood.
I'm not
maybe.
Sure what the too Hollywood. Yeah, 9/11 had that feeling at least for a while. I didn't like it at all when I first heard 9/11, and it sounded to me like the kind of phrase a press agent would coin for the date of a product launch.
It's interesting how it slowly worked its way into our usage.
Yeah.
I think about a month ago it began, and now September 11th is a mouthful and we respect and use it, but 9/11 is there too.
Right, and I think 9/11 or September 11, as opposed to September 11th, has the advantage of being a kind of more abstract term that refers not just to what happened on that date, but to this whole custard of events that's been accumulating around it.
Jack Beatty, what catches you about this circumspection that we hear in people's approach to language this fall?
Well, what I've noticed is that in talking about the causes of the terrorism, we all become very circumspect. We don't want to say that the terrorism was caused by something we did.
Mm-hmm.
So that even in thinking about it historically, I think we get into trouble with the word cause because of its kinship with justification. If something is caused, then it seems to be motivated.
It has a reason.
It's
not pure disembodied evil.
That's right. That's right. And that sort of even our historical reconstruction of how this happened. For example, we have troops based in Saudi Arabia. Bin Laden says this is his reason for war.
Mm-hmm.
That reason is so at variance with what happened. I mean, there's the gap between them is so great that, and also you seem to be. It's easy to seem to be as if you're forgiving him by giving him reasons. I think that whole vocabulary has been inhibited a good deal by the events. I wonder what you think about that, Jeffrey.
Yeah, no, I agree absolutely. Any attempt to discuss the kind of political situation that gave rise to the resentment, if not to the terrorist attacks themselves, anytime anybody brings up, are you saying it's our fault?
Mm-hmm.
Sit down. Yeah. We're talking tonight about language, about words, and a new kind of war. Are you changing the way you speak, the words you use? What are the words that define this season, this war for you? And what about the language of innocence and blame? Has it left us free to question and think? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Jack Beatty, talk to us for a minute about America's wars and how they've shaped America's language over time.
Well, American prose style, to say nothing of the language strategies of corporate speak, among other sort of discourses of manipulation, they owe a great deal to our war. Edmund Wilson observed that the prose style after the Civil War changed dramatically. He said prose became modeled on the battle telegraph, attack at dawn, hit at the enemy flank. And he contrasts Edward Everett's florid oration at Gettysburg with Lincoln's terse eloquence on the same occasion. And he says that's the paradigm of the new style that came into American writing and language after the Civil War. With World War I, there's an interesting contrast between Woodrow Wilson's messianic rhetoric and Ernest Hemingway's reflection in his World War I novel, A Farewell to Arms, that the Wilsonian phrases like in vain and words like sacrifice and valor had no meaning to veterans of industrial combat, and only the names of places had dignity. And this sort of reaction to Wilsonian rhetoric really began to characterize American writing and language in the 20s. The Second War brought us what Jeffrey calls Gilbert and Sullivan language from President Roosevelt, Day of Infamy, Dastardly Attack, the language that distanced the country from the Pearl Harbor disaster, much as the removal of all dead bodies from the newsreel reports of Pearl Harbor sanitized the events. Harry Truman got into no end of trouble in 1950 when he agreed with a reporter that the country was not involved in the Korean War, but a, quote, police action under the United Nations. Well, it's terrible enough to lose your son in a war, but calling it a police action must make it worse. In Vietnam, the Kennedy, Johnson, and Nixon administration sought to limit the damage to themselves, political damage, by using locutions like interdiction to describe carpet bombing, pacification to mask the Phoenix program assassination of suspected Viet Cong leaders and sympathizers, and urbanization to hide the cruel realities of a policy aimed at driving rural peoples from their home. George Orwell really had the classic comment, not only about government speak in wartime, but about so much else, when he wrote that, quote, most writing about international politics is an attempt to make murder sound respectable and to give the appearance of solidity to pure wind.
Jeff Nunberg, count on Jack Media to give us plenty to chew on.
Oh, that's wonderful. Well, yeah, that's a wonderful
question. What about President Bush? He's writing the next chapter right now in the Bush administration and Don Rumsfeld at the Pentagon. We've got the briefings every day, and John Ashcroft. What new language or new trends in language do you see coming out of their framing of this peculiar war?
Well, I think Bush is certainly continuing the tradition of what Edmund Wilson that Jack was mentioning called patriotic gore. There's a lot of high-flown language coming out of Washington. One tradition that began a bit later, really with Bush's father, was this naming of operations to suggest some propaganda goal. So that began with Just Cause in Panama, which is the first of those, and then
that's really the first of those. Now they seem as though we've always done it.
Yeah, well, in the Second World War, Churchill in particular, you know, there were these names like Overlord and Avalanche. Mm-hmm. They were these very Churchill actually liked to name operations after things like racehorses because he didn't want a name that would have the wrong connotations if the operation went awry. And he was somebody who, better than anybody else, has a sense of the irony of history, and he didn't want to have to
leave himself open to that.
Call the mothers of soldiers who'd been killed and said, your son died in Operation Victory or something. Mm-hmm. So certainly Infinite Justice, which was a mistake, and then Enduring, what are we in now? In
enduring freedom.
Which is also kind of a weird, you know, it's ambiguous. I'm not sure if freedom is supposed to be something you have to put up with and endure.
What about evildoers? I mean, how do you dope that?
Evildoer, certainly a term like that, and out of that Victorian, Bush uses it now almost as like a pronoun, right, the evildoer.
Mm-hmm.
It's out of that Victorian trunk that a lot of people seem to have rolled out after 9/11. And I sure hope it's not part of it. Homeland's another one that disturbs me a lot.
Why does it disturb you, Jeff Nunberg?
Well, it's a kind of word. It's certainly an English word, but it's not a word we ever use of ourselves. You know, the Germans have a home. They have Heimat.
German residents than English there.
The Ukrainians and so on. But we think of America as a place you come to, not a place you come from. And it does suggest that idea of an ancestral connection with a certain plot of ground
We've always been a country as opposed to a nation in the sense of a shared blood.
Right, right.
Homeland,
and I think that
kind of
homeland
speaks to the shared blood idea, doesn't
suggestion
it?
And the shared connection to this, as if we all came from here rather than coming to here. And as if what we had in common was the place rather than the ideals that make us a nation.
I'm struck at how George W. Bush interlaces this high-blown and sometimes Victorian rhetoric with a lot of Texasism, that kind of down and dirty, dead or alive, you know, how would you like him? It doesn't matter to me. When it gets down to the real life and death issues around Osama bin Laden, he goes for the Texas posse language that signals very loud and clear, just go get him.
Yeah, no, I think that's surely the case. Jack may have thoughts about that. That's surely the case. There's a lot of testosterone in that language, too.
We're at 1-800-423-8255, talking with Jeffrey Nunberg about language, the war on terrorism, the whole season that we're in. What words, what phrases are catching your attention since 9/11? Babuti is calling from Nashua, New Hampshire. Welcome. You're on the air.
Hi. I have a comment. Remember, just after 9/11, we used words like dead or alive, somebody who has a diaper on his head should be taken out.
One congressman used that phrase.
Yeah, things like that. I mean, but after that, all died down. That proves that even though, like, out of passion or out of anger, momentarily we lose our intelligence, we come back to life. I mean, that shows the humanity in us. And that's how the, I mean, after we come back to life, we go. I mean, if we remember, like, the discussion you had with the minister last hour, it goes back to that. Like, you start questioning yourself. Are you responsible partly for all these things? Once you start doing that, you become more milder in using your words.
It's a great point. And, of course, I guess it's heartening in some way because, of course, the language could go the other way. In many conflicts around the world, in many historical moments, it has. I remember well in Rwanda how things went from criticism to calling the Tutsis cockroaches. And once they were dehumanized in that way, all hell broke loose. Thanks for your call, Babuti. And Jeff Nunberg, what about the evolutionary trend of our language around this crisis and what it signals to you?
Well, I don't know that the language is going to change a lot in response to this crisis. I mean, there are a few words that have come in there.
But I guess to this specific point of it becoming more or less volatile, and our caller saying it's becoming less volatile, less charged with racial and ethnic animosity and cliché. Do you see that? Do you share that view?
I share that view when I listen to NPR. I listen to AM talk shows at the left end of the dial. I hear raghead and I hear language like that still bandied about, and it's very hard to get a sense of what the whole country's thinking. But and I think the immediate rage that led to a lot of unfortunate incidents right after 9/11 has subsided a little bit, but I still hear talk like that, and I don't know that we've got past that.
What about the basic word that's at play here, the basic label that the U.S. government has put on this effort, which is war? Do you imagine that there was some debate over the use of that word to describe what we're now engaged in?
I suspect not enough that the idea that this might be thought of also as a police action, the phrase that Truman used, really didn't occur to a lot of people. And people wanted to make war on terrorism, and now we've got a war on terrorism.
Jack Beatty, what do you think of the implications of labeling this a war?
Well, there was actually a piece in the New York Times today that pointed out that by calling it a war, we are saying that people whom we catch are prisoners of war, and therefore they need the protections of the Geneva Convention.
Which we've been a little reluctant to extend this time.
That's right, and which are in conflict with the Bush administration's ideas about military tribunals and so on. So that even the kind of lexical, the framing of the conflict or as a war has kind of got us in contradiction at least a little bit with what the president wants to do with people who are apprehended. He wants to treat them as criminals. And in fact, I think he calls them as, you know, non-justified combatants. But if it's a war, they are prisoners of war, and they have all these protections coming to them. So we're kind of getting a lexical trap there, I think.
Yeah, I think that's a very good point. I think it's a corner we've been painting ourselves into for some time. We've gotten so used to these metaphors of war. We had a war on poverty. We had a war on drugs. Corporations routinely use the language of war, road warriors and scorched earth policy and so forth to describe their own, and campaigns certainly, to describe their own. About the only place in which military and bellicose rhetoric isn't pervasive is in the military itself. They avoid it. They don't kill anybody. They take them out.
What was Kolopal's word for describing Kunduz? For surrounding
we're going to invest it.
Invest it. Talk about a word out of military history.
Right. And assets. We have assets. They have assets. So the only place people still talk about business, use the language of business, is in the Pentagon, not in the corporate boardroom.
We're talking about words and war, this unusual war that we're engaged in with Jeffrey Nunberg and our own News analyst Jack Beattie, you can join the conversation. What words are you finding most illuminating, most maddening this season? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Steve is on the line. Welcome, Steve. You're on the air.
I wanted to ask the guests what they thought of President Bush's use of the word evil to the frequency that he does use it. I don't disagree at all with the idea that bin Laden is evil. But I think the many religious traditions teach that one should be careful about using such words so often because they numb our own moral sensitivity.
Steve, thanks for your call. Jeffrey Nunberg, what about it, this word evil? How deep a drawer was that pulled out of, and what do you think are the implications of its use?
Well, I think the implications of the use are this need to go to religious language to find a justification for the response. In a certain sense, it troubles me for two reasons. First of all, it's always troubling to hear that kind of religious language brought into the American political debate or discussion, even when, in this case, there's a strong case to be made that bin Laden is indeed an evil man.
You mean because of church-state separation issues?
Well, because you hope that evildoer isn't a word that's around in 10 years in the American political discourse. It's once you start, it's a slippery slope. And the other thing is that it tends to support that along with the word crusade that Bush used and then pulled back, in which, of course, bin Laden has been now turning around and using to describe Bush, the great crusader, the big crusader. Language like that tends to support, I think, the idea that this is for America a religious war, maybe not to American ears, but I suspect to ears in the Middle East, it's troubling. It's troubling for that reason as well.
On the other hand, Jack Beattie, there's another perspective. We had on last week Daniel Pipes, the Jerusalem Post columnist and Middle East Forum director, who said he saw the word evil and its use by Bush as a kind of euphemistic way of avoiding saying Islamic radical. Of avoiding naming names and putting this big umbrella over everything that Muslims would not find so offensive.
That's a very interesting read of it. Yeah, that hadn't occurred to me. I mean, my sense of it was that it stops thinking. I mean, evil is a sort of self-caused thing. Someone does something out of evil. You don't say, well, what caused the evil? The evil is sort of the prime mover.
It was just evil.
It was the cause of causes. And that gets us back to this idea of what caused the terrorism. What was the background of the terrorism? If you say evil, it sort of stops the mind. And, it was evil that caused this. And we don't start thinking about anti-colonial politics and how we've got into the sights of people who, take out their revenge against the British Empire or our empire against us and so on. And so it gets away from thinking about a way out, really, a long-term way out, I think.
And of course, there's just the word enemy. That one everyone's embraced quite easily, Jeff Nunberg. No one seems to hitch up on that one this time, to hiccup on it.
No, I don't think anybody should have a problem with describing
the proof is in
the enemy. Yeah,
the proof is in the tragedy. Another interesting word here. The 9/11 and tragedy, as opposed to what, Jeff Nunberg?
Well, I think some people are reluctant to describe it as a tragedy because in a tragedy, there's often a sense, at least for some people, of the victims having in some way contributed to the to what happened, and that surely isn't the case of the people who died in the World Trade Center or in the Pentagon.
We're talking this hour with author Jeffrey Nunberg. He's got a new book out, The Way We Talk Now. He's professor of linguistics at Stanford University. How is language helping you grapple with the new realities? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR Boston. This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking tonight with Jeffrey Nunberg, author of The Way We Talk Now, about words, language, and the war on terrorism, everything really, since 9/11. What words are illuminating for you this season? What words make you mad? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Marilyn is on the line. Hi, Marilyn.
Hello. Thank you for this program. I think it's so important. I've been thinking about language for a long time, and since September 11th, acutely conscious of the language that we've been using.
What's striking you, Marilyn?
Now, could, if I do have something I want to tell you. So it isn't so much, I don't want to respond, if you don't mind, just for a moment, to your question, because you actually have touched on some of it. I mean, you've mentioned the words that have been disturbing me, evil, mm-hmm. war, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I listen a lot to, I love to hear Jeffrey Nunberg, and I love Jack Beatty as a host, and you too, of course. And I think that the point that these words stop us from thinking is extremely important. Mm-hmm. But what I wanted to say to you was that your program is about how language shapes consciousness. Let me just say it in another way, in another sentence. The way we describe things, the words that we use to describe things, we become. And when we use words, the words like evil, etc., we become in some ways like our enemy. And let me give you an example, just one small example. And I'm just going to paraphrase a couple of lines from a poem by the Israeli poet Yehuda Amichai. Mm-hmm. It's a poem called I May I Rest in Peace. And in it, he talks about battle, war, and words. He says, I've been in many wars in my life, and he talks about the enemies, and he says, and I meet my lover face, my enemy face. And then he says, and I have fought battles with the old weapons, axes, arrows, etc., and words, and with the newfangled weapons, missiles and machine guns, etc., and words. Mm-hmm. And that is such an important point. And I think that the discourse that goes on now is critical in the way we're going to be thinking not only about the war, like, for example, permanent war that the Bush administration mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. is talking about, but it's going to shape the way we, as a community, America as a community, I also really detest the word homeland, but we're a society that has been a community with common goals, common ideals.
Marilyn, would you pull the word evil out of our discourse?
Oh, I really, yes, I would. I definitely would.
Marilyn,
I definitely would be. And in great part because they look at us as evil. Where does it get us? And people have to think. People have to think.
Goes to tit for tat.
And that means that you don't use slogans. Oh, let me just make one more point. And
make it a fast one, Marilyn. We've got a lot of people who want to join us.
I will. And that is that when you listen to the radio, you hear the language of sports, of business, and of war used interchangeably. Think what this does to the national consciousness.
Marilyn, thanks for your call. It's good points all. Jeffrey Nunberg, any chance that in our media age, high speed and often AM, as you say, that we'll pull away from the kind of sloganeering that goes along with a period of conflict, a period of national trauma, and then war?
You know, I guess I don't see much possibility because it's really part not just of our political discourse, but of the way we just brand experience. And in a sense, there's no difference now between the wars that we're trying to sell and the products that we're trying to sell. It's language has this effect. I would disagree with Marilyn's mm-hmm. very well-taken points, and only in one sense, and that is that I don't think that in the end we're wholly the prisoners of language. I think we can see there's a line from another poem, if I can quote it, from Auden, Kairos and Logos, where he says, "What one notices, if one will trust one's eyes, the shadow cast by language upon mm-hmm. truth." Mm-hmm. And I think there's a mm-hmm. sense in which you can always, in some sense, if you think hard enough, get past the language to see experience as it is.
We're not helpless observers or slaves of the language.
We can think critically about language, and we have mm-hmm. to think critically about language, but mm-hmm. we can get past it.
Mm-hmm. Jeff Nunberg, let's try and get another call or two in here. Allison is on the line. Welcome, Allison. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you. Mm-hmm. I was just wondering if your guest would comment on quite the opposite tack, not the warlike words, but the cultural words that Americans are trying to grasp now that, you know, many of the Islamic customs are coming to the fore and being highlighted in the context of war.
What comes to mind with for you, Allison?
For me, Ramadan, as well as some of the
jihad.
No, jihad was one I was going to try and avoid.
Sorry.
The non-war, like the cultural words.
Oh, I see. You're saying that indicate a greater awareness
exactly.
of the other culture.
I'm finding that many people have asked me questions. I've been fortunate to write a couple of articles mm-hmm. and take some classes on Islam. And people are asking me to help them with the words that help them understand the culture.
Mm-hmm.
You know, why do women wear the headscarves,
mm-hmm.
and what are they called, and what's with the burqas, and mm-hmm. and once they start to understand those labels, they gain an insight that is not the slogans that are just the sound bites on TV.
Mm. Allison, thanks for your call. Jack Beattie, what about it? Are we being piece by piece equipped with the vocabulary to have a conversation that just wasn't possible before?
I think that says it very well. We're beginning to get the terms. We're getting some of, and with these terms comes a wider understanding. I mean, the phrase the prophet, Muhammad, mm-hmm. Mecca, the burqa, all of these things come dripping culture and tradition and history, and even to use them is to somehow pick up some of that. So I quite agree with what Allison says.
Jeff Dunberg, do you see that, the greater familiarity with the Islamic world coming through words piece by piece now, bit by bit?
Certainly that's true. I think Jack's right, and there's been this enormous interest in Islam and all the bestsellers about Islam. And I think the words, in a certain sense, the words tend to be distorted on both sides. I thought it was very interesting the way bin Laden turned Bush's word. I mean, crusade is a word that we use. We don't hear the cross in it. It's mm-hmm. but in Arabic, the word for crusade is literally the campaign of the cross. And when bin Laden...
Inextricable there.
Inextricable. And I think in the same way, we hear words a little differently. Jihad is actually an interesting word. I was talking to a friend who's a medieval Arabic historian, and she was saying, well, you know, it's a word, it can mean holy war, but it can also mean any kind of personal moral struggle. And she said, for me, jihad this year is being chair of the department.
And that's, I think, that's the permanent jihad.
Right. And I think in a way it's like crusade. I mean, it has a rich number of meanings that and sometimes people on the other side of the wall only hear one.
Yeah. Jeff Dunberg, you always alert us to the rich number of meetings. We thank you for being with us tonight.
Thank you very much. This was great. And thank Jack, too.
Thank you.
Jeff Dunberg is author of the new book, The Way We Talk Now, Commentaries on Language and Culture from NPR's Fresh Air. He's a professor of linguistics at Stanford University and chair of the usage panel of the American Heritage Dictionary. Jack Beattie, we've just got another minute. I'm thinking of other absent words. Hawks and doves were in war, but those old labels don't seem to have much usage right now.
No, they don't. It doesn't fit the current case. I mean, we have people who dissent about the methods of the mm-hmm. war, and certainly mm-hmm. the domestic war on terrorism has a lot, but no one is saying, you know, we shouldn't be defending ourselves.
Or that you're necessarily hawk-like at the moment for saying we want justice and we don't mind using the military to get it.
That's right.
Or noble in the way of the dove suggested around pushing for peace. And yet one knows that those words are always floating out there somewhere.
Yeah, but, you know, it was George Aiken of Vermont who used those the first time about Vietnam. And it was George Aiken who also said about Vietnam, maybe we should just declare victory and come home. And, of course, we may be doing that in Afghanistan if we don't get bin Laden.
Yeah, we may be.
The Aiken solution.
Declare victory and come home. But we're told there is no coming home this time. Even home, that's an interesting word. I wish we had Jeff Dunberg. But that, which once in the American lexicon was a kind of inviolable place, no longer inviolable.
Oh, boy, that's right. Home has got blood on it for the first time.
There's a loss in a word that we hate to see colored quite that way.
Yeah.
Jack, it's great to have you here tonight. Thanks for joining us this
Your pleasure.
Hour. You can continue this conversation online. Go to WBUR.org and click on Special Coverage Forums. The Stress Support Unit of the Boston Police Department looks out for the psychological health of its officers. Officer Michael O'Sullivan is the director of that unit. In this radio diary, he talks about working in New York to support police officers, firemen, and other relief workers.
The Stress Support Unit actually has been in existence since 1974. We pretty much focus now on critical incident stress and the response to that for the officers and what we can do to help them with that. We see officers after critical incidents. We see officers having trouble with just marital relationships or boyfriend-girlfriend problems, depression, the whole gamut of anything you'd see in civilian life. We came to work in 9/11, and we watched the second plane crash into the towers, and I knew right then and there we were going to have some problems, because we immediately said, God, think of all the cops and firemen that are in there trying to get people out. And we have officers down there every week now. And what we did originally, we just went out and did what we call diffusings with officers, where around Ground Zero there were hundreds of police officers. Some were digging, some were on details, like where they were guarding streets or limiting access to the public. And we would just go up to each one and ask them how they were doing. And I'd say a third of them actually had been there. Those are the people I talked to. I probably talked to 200 people over the 2 weeks that I was there. But what we do is we just allow them to have a friendly face to vent a little bit. Often what happens is their story just flows for quite a while, and you get an awful lot of emotion. But we worked with firemen, police officers, construction workers, anybody that would talk, we talked to them. The officers down there seem to like people from Boston. There's a little rivalry that's gone on for many years with New York City, and there's always the, what about those Red Sox type of thing, you know, and expletives are, are exchanged, and then you get into talking about things. Yeah. 99% of the time, we strike up a pretty good conversation with the officers. The second time we went down, one of our team members, Lieutenant Zink, thought it would be a good idea to go over to the Staten Island site where they were sorting through the debris from the World Trade Center. So he went over with Detective Richie DeVoe from District 6, and they ended up establishing a pretty good relationship right off with the people over there, and now we've sent quite a few people over there. I've been told it's quite a scene over there. A lot of the vehicles, or the crushed vehicles, are there, and one of my officers was telling me that it's like walking around a big gray graveyard. You see the fire trucks, that some of them are completely intact, but you know everybody on that truck is dead. The thing that probably hit me the most about when I was down there the first week was realizing how many people that the police officers and the firefighters actually saved. That death toll would have been tremendous had they not been in there, and they died doing it. Some people estimated that they got out as many as 20,000 people. Because people tend, when they come out of a building, you know, they just congregate around it. They don't run. And they just kept pushing people out and pushing people out, and in the process saved thousands and thousands of people's lives. Certainly the attitude of everybody has changed quite a bit in New York City in regard to the police department. I have never been treated as well as I was in New York City. You know, we were in uniform, and people were throwing food at us everywhere. They wanted to feed us. They wanted, you know, waving to us. And it's a really unique experience, because it's never happened to me before as a police officer. It's a little perplexing at times, because you know that it's going to go back to the same old usual at some point. You know, everybody's going to not really like us all that much again. And, you know what's going to happen. There's one guy from one of the Bronx precincts said to me, they still hate us in the Bronx. But outside of that, I think it's a real refreshing experience to have people wave to you and smile at you. It's very rarely do you see people smile at you in this job. Police are very human people, like firefighters. You know, we're not gods or any better than anybody else. The one thing, they'll always run into the building. Don't ask me why, but we do.
Michael O'Sullivan is the director of the Stress Support Unit for the Boston Police Department. We'd like to hear from you. Send your radio diary submissions by email. The address is special@wbur.org. You can read or listen to other radio diaries on our website. Log on to wbur.org and click on Special Coverage. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR Boston.
This is W.